The official patronage to the blasphemers by the French government have added fuel to fire in Pakistan, like elsewhere in the Muslim world.
If someone speaks against the dignity and honor of Rasulullah alayhi salatu wasalam, then we will say, my mother, my father, my children, each and every one of them, I am ready to sacrifice them on the dignity and honor of Rasulullah alayhi salatu wasalam. Now we are not going to tolerate it anymore, until and unless the ambassador of France would have been kicked out from Pakistan, we will be here inshallah ta'ala.
When you abuse of Prophet, when you insult him, nauzubillah, and then when you keep doing it again and again, then we'll definitely respond. Everybody in this world will respond if you keep hurting their sentiments.
In retaliation to controversial remarks of French president against Islam, protesters insulted his images. Anti-France sentiments have surged suddenly at an unprecedented level after repeated incidents of blasphemy of Islam. Similar protests were also held across Pakistan. Like elsewhere in the Muslim world, people have started boycotting French products in Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that France under President Macron is encouraging Islamophobia, which is creating further polarization and marginalization of Muslims in the West, that he believes would inevitably lead towards radicalization in the world. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The world's largest banks in 2019 provided more than $2.6 trillion in loans and underwriting to economic sectors linked to the global biodiversity crisis, while doing little to monitor, let alone curb, damage to life-sustaining ecosystems. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Bankrolling Extinction. Report shows big banks lent over $2.6 trillion to fund global biodiversity destruction in 2019. Here's the details of this article. The world's largest banks in 2019 provided more than $2.6 trillion in loans and underwriting to economic sectors linked to the global biodiversity crisis, while doing little to monitor, let alone curb, damage to life-sustaining ecosystems. That's according to Bankrolling Extinction, a new report published recently by Portfolio Earth, an initiative seeking to challenge the financial industry's role in ecological devastation. The analysis was described as a frightening statement of the status quo by Dr. Robert Weston, former chair of both UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, that is IPBES, and Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. Mark Campolone, founder and executive chair of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, said in a statement released recently that this report reminds us that there is no time to lose for governments and financial regulators to create an appropriate rules-based system to oversee and ensure that banks cannot continue to finance this corporate planetary plunder unconstrained and unnoticed. Environmental destruction, the report authors wrote, can no longer be seen as an unfortunate byproduct of economic development. Rather, the COVID-19 pandemic has demonstrated that healthy, biodiverse environments underpin the functioning of our health, societies, and economies. Researchers found that 50 global banks invested more than the entire GDP of Canada in the food, forestry, mining, fossil fuels, infrastructure, tourism, transport, and logistics sectors, activities that IPBES has identified as the major drivers of biodiversity loss. The top 10 offenders were Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Mizuho Financial, Wells Fargo, BNP Paribas, Mitsubishi UFJ Financial, HSBC, MSBC Group, and Barclays. Moreover, the report notes that none of the banks assessed had sufficient systems in place to monitor or measure the impact of their loans on biodiversity loss, nor do they have comprehensive policies to halt it. According to the authors, private financial institutions on Wall Street and elsewhere are unwilling and ill-prepared to promote biodiversity, despite its significance to human life and survival, thanks in part to the fact that the regulators and rules which govern banks currently protect them from any consequences. Instead of heeding scientists' warnings about biological annihilation and its consequences, the financial sector is bankrolling the mass extinction crisis while undermining human rights and indigenous sovereignty. While governments and companies have been the focus of attention on this issue, they continued, actors in the finance sector have largely evaded scrutiny until recently, even though it is their investment decisions that shape the transformation of ecosystems. The report argues that to prevent extinction, banks have to stop funding it. To this end, the researchers call for banks to disclose and radically reduce their impact on nature and stop finance for new fossil fuels, deforestation, overfishing, and ecosystem destruction. Governments to stop protecting the role of banks in biodiversity destruction and rewrite the rules of finance to hold banks liable for the damage caused by their lending, and people everywhere to have a say in how their money is invested, and a right to stop banks from causing serious harm to people and planet. Maura Burth, climate and finance director of Amazon Watch, said that if the Amazon rainforest is going to survive, and if we are to have a future on this planet, financial institutions must stop funneling trillions of dollars into the very industries unabashedly driving biodiversity loss. By maintaining a global system fundamentally based on eternal economic growth and never-ending exploitation of natural elements, said Hannah Begovich of Earth Advocacy Youth, we allow for life on Earth to be considered human-owned property whose point of existence is to be exploited and commodified for human benefit and economic profit. Kai Chan, a professor at the University of British Columbia and a leading author of the IPBES Global Assessment Report, noted that a global sustainable economy sits at the center of the humanity's much-needed transformation to meet the climate and ecological crises. And at the center of that, Chan added, sit the banks and the finance institutions whose investments power development around the globe. According to Todd Paglia, Executive Director at the Stand.Earth, today's visionary financial institutions are those that invest in projects that regenerate our oceans, forests, and climate. We need to reverse the damage of several centuries of banks investing in the destruction of the heart, lungs, and limbs of our planet, he added, and do so in short order. Robin Smale, director of Vivid Economics, pointed out that the current legal system protects banks from responsibility and liability and therefore reduces their business incentive to help address damaging activities. Smale argued that removing these legal protections would force banks to more systematically address the biodiversity impacts of their financing and transform activities across major supply chains. Imagine a world, said Chan, in which projects can only raise capital when they have demonstrated that they will contribute meaningfully and positively to restoring the planet's bounty and a safe climate for all. That's the future this report envisions and builds toward, he concluded.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The birthday of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history.
We can liken the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, to the brightest star in the universe. Why do I say he is like a bright star? Not the sun. It is because the sun is a definite celestial body. It is bright and magnificent, but it is a celestial body. However, among the stars that you see, there are some which are galaxies and are thousands of times larger than the one we see in summer nights. A galaxy is a collection of thousands of solar systems and suns. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, was like a galaxy, and he had thousands of virtues which shone brightly like a star.
You are my one true love, taught me to never judge. Now all I want is to be with you.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Mustafa على حبيبك نبيك مصطفى اللهم صل على سيدنا مصطفى على حبيبك نبيك مصطفى
In him, knowledge is accompanied by morality. Government is accompanied by wisdom. Worshipping God is accompanied by serving people. Jihad is accompanied by mercy. Love of God is accompanied by love of His creatures. Pride is accompanied by modesty. Being up to date is accompanied by foresight. Honesty is accompanied by complexity. In political matters, attention to God is accompanied by attention to peace and health. Attention to worldly matters is accompanied by attention to spiritual matters. And pursuing divine goals is accompanied by pursuing human goals. He is a perfect example of a human being, and God Almighty has not created a person who is as perfect as him. He is a bearer of good news and he is a warner. He knows what all humanity is doing and he knows everything that happens in history. He is the person who invites all humanity to get close to God, and he is a shining beacon of guidance for humanity.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Chinese documents show that U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross did not successfully step down from all of his corporate commitments. Wilbur Ross, an investor turned U.S. Commerce Secretary, has long been accused of ethical violations because of his failure to extricate himself from his business ties. Documents obtained by Foreign Policy magazine show that Wilbur Ross's potential conflicts of interest around Chinese businesses are greater than previously known. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Isaac Stone Fish and has been taken from the Foreign Policy magazine. The piece is titled, Wilbur Ross Remained on Chinese Joint Venture Board Whilst Running U.S.-China Trade War. Stay with us, for more of Isaac Stone Fisher's article. Chinese documents show that the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross did not successfully step down from all of his corporate commitments. Wilbur Ross, an investor turned U.S. Commerce Secretary, has long been accused of ethical violations because of his failure to extricate himself from his business ties. Documents obtained by Foreign Policy magazine show that Ross's potential conflicts of interest around Chinese businesses are greater than previously known. In Chinese corporate documents obtained by Foreign Policy magazine, Wilbur Ross is listed as serving on the board of a Chinese joint venture until January of 2019, nearly 2 years into his term as U.S. Commerce Secretary. That joint venture, now called Huaneng Invesco WLR Beijing Investment Fund Management Co., is an investment partnership formed in September of 2008 between Huaneng Capital Services, the U.S. management company Invesco, and a firm Wilbur Ross founded, W.L. Ross & Co. Huaneng Capital Services is an arm of China Huaneng Group, a major state-owned power producer in China. The documents correspond to the information found on Chinese corporate data sites, such as Qichacha and Qichinbao, including the date of board membership. The documents don't say if Wilbur Ross was paid for his board seat or whether there is any current financial relationship between Ross and the joint venture. It's also unclear if Wilbur Ross knew that he remained on the board seat. The more recent documents don't include the signatures or seals of the individual board members. That Chinese document states Wilbur Ross was on the board of a Chinese joint venture until January of 2019 has not been previously reported. The U.S.-China trade war started heating up in the summer of 2018, as Beijing and Washington levied increasingly onerous tariffs on each other. At the same time as Wilbur Ross was overseeing the trade war as U.S. Commerce Secretary, he was still, according to paperwork, on the board of a joint venture that was a partnership with a Chinese state-owned firm. Instead of reporting on well-documented facts, including a dated and signed letter of resignation that I provided them, Foreign Policy magazine is purporting a false narrative that I remained on the board of a Chinese company, citing Chinese documents, Wilbur Ross replied in a statement sent by U.S. Commerce Department. It is clear which Foreign Policy magazine actually support, and the American public deserves better. The letter that Wilbur Ross provided to Foreign Policy magazine is dated 27th of February 2017, marked confidential, and has as its subject line, regarding resignation from WLR entities. In the letter addressed to W.L. Ross & Co., Wilbur Ross writes that he shall be deemed to have retired, resigned, or withdrawn from every entity affiliated with W.L. Ross & Co. Wilbur Ross lists dozens of companies that he claims the letter applies to, including those affiliated with Huaneng. But Chinese corporate law experts, consulted by Foreign Policy magazine, say that under Chinese law, writing a private letter to a U.S. parent company does not remove one from Chinese corporate boards. The failure to withdraw from the board may have just been an inadvertent slip, but what you said is clearly not a false narrative, said Fred Rockefort, an attorney at the international law firm Harris Bricken. Chinese corporate records establish without a doubt that Wilbur Ross was officially on the board until 1st of February 2019. Wilbur Ross's position as U.S. Commerce Secretary allowed him to influence the direction of the U.S.-China trade war, that America's global and America's global trade policies. Whilst there is no evidence that Ross directly benefited from the joint venture while serving as Commerce Secretary, entanglements like this have traditionally been seen as potential violations of the national interest. Public trust demands that all employees act in public's interest and are free from any actual or perceived conflict of interest when fulfilling governmental responsibilities entrusted to them. The then acting director of the U.S. Office of Government Ethics wrote to Wilbur Ross in a July 2018 letter about other inadvertent ethical violations. On 20th of March 2017, less than a month after Wilbur Ross was confirmed as U.S. Commerce Secretary, the joint venture entered into a partnership with a parent company, Huaneng and Taikang Asset Management Company, a subsidiary of the major Chinese insurance firm Taikang. The companies agreed to raise about $745 million to invest in renewable energy projects, a market that Wilbur Ross had influence over at the U.S. Commerce Department and which was directly affected by trade tariffs. Ross's relationship to the Taikang partnership has not been previously reported. One set of documents that Foreign Policy magazine obtained, dated March 2018, showed that the joint venture filed paperwork stating which of its previous board members would continue to serve on the board. Wilbur Ross's name is on that list. Another document from January of 2019 removes Ross from the board and appoints the investor Nadim Qureshi as a new board member. Qureshi served on the board until September of 2020. The joint venture affixed its seal to the document. Under Chinese law, a seal is generally seen as more official than a signature. Wilbur Ross attended a board meeting in September of 2012 and signed an agreement with other directors to, among other changes, increase the company's registered capital to about $25 million and its total investment to $76 million and to change the name of the joint venture from Huaneng Investco WLR Investment Consulting Co. to its current name. Long bullish about investing in China, Wilbur Ross and his firm WL Ross & Co., along with Invesco, formed the joint venture to tap into private equity investments in power generation in China, the firm said in a 2008 press release. Back in 2000, Wilbur Ross founded the private equity firm WL Ross & Co., which focused on distressed assets. He sold the firm to the money manager Ambescap, now Invesco, in 2006. Wilbur Ross continued to serve as the chief executive officer of Invesco's private equity group until joining the government in February of 2017. But Ross only sold his shares in Invesco in December of 2017, nearly a year into his tenure as the U.S. Commerce Secretary. He was supposed to sell his shares valued between $10 million and $50 million before the end of May of 2017. But the non-profit Center for Public Integrity found that because Invesco's stock rose in the meantime, the delay netted Wilbur Ross between $1.2 million and $6 million. I discovered that the previously held stock had not been sold. I then promptly sold these shares, Wilbur Ross later wrote in a disclosure. Wilbur Ross has been repeatedly warned about ethics violations. In his December 2016 ethics disclosure form, Wilbur Ross disclosed that he was on the board of Huaneng Joint Venture from 2008 until present. In March 2018, the non-profit liberal advocacy group Public Citizen released a report titled Follow the Money. Did administration officials' financial entanglements with China delay Trump's promised tough on China trade policy? The report discusses many of Wilbur Ross's alleged conflict of interest with China, including his relationship with Diamond S Shipping, a Connecticut-headquartered firm that at the time was partially owned by the Chinese government. The report also mentions Ross's relationship with Huaneng. In a September 2019 interview with the Washington Post, Wilbur Ross denied ever having any conflict of interest whilst in office. In July of 2018, the Office of Government Ethics wrote a scathing public letter to Wilbur Ross, criticizing him for various omissions and inaccurate statements in his disclosure forms and compliance documents. Even inadvertent errors regarding compliance with your ethical obligations can undermine public trust in both you and the overall ethics program, the letter stated. In response, Wilbur Ross filed an extensive annual financial disclosure report for that year. In February of 2019, the director of the Office of Government Ethics refused to certify the report because Wilbur Ross didn't sell all of his shares in the Florida-based bank, Bank United. But there was another possible error in Ross's 2018 financial disclosure report. In that report, Ross claims that he had left the Huaneng joint venture in February of 2017, but according to Chinese law, he was still a director of the joint venture until 1st of February 2019. This error, however, inadvertent on Ross's financial disclosure report, has not been previously reported.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Sudanese people have held a rally in protest against a joint statement from Israel, Sudan, and the U.S. regarding working toward a normalization agreement with Tel Aviv. Political parties have rejected the decision and promised to form an opposition front against it. The news was announced after Washington removed Sudan from its terror list and offered it access to billions of dollars of desperately needed financial assistance. This, of course, after Sudan agreed to pay $335 million in compensation to the victims of al-Qaeda bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. Stay with us for a debate of the issue.
Sudan agreed on Friday to take steps to normalize ties with Israel in a deal brokered by the United States. President Donald Trump sealed the agreement in a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and Transitional Council head Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The normalization drew strong criticism from Palestinians who have already expressed opposition to similar deals by the UAE and Bahrain. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the agreement as a violation of UN Security Council and Arab League resolutions. The resistance movement Hamas slammed the deal as a political sin, while the Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the move a betrayal of the Palestinian people and their cause. Separately, Abbas Fattah movement also denounced the deal.
We totally denouncing this deal, and we are sure that the Sudanese people, intellectuals, Sudanese national parties, the people of Sudan also will reject this deal.
Sudan's agreement also sparked strong criticism at home, with several political parties warning that they would form a national front against the Israel deal. Khartoum's decision had already stirred up anti-Israel sentiments in the country, where protesters set fire to the regime's flag. Sudanese say the deal is not in favor of their country.
Against normalization, because normalization does not serve the interests of Sudan, neither now nor tomorrow.
Sudan agreed to normalize its relations with Israel after the U.S. president announced about removing the African nation from its so-called list of state sponsors of terrorism. Trump tweeted that Khartoum had agreed to pay $335 million in compensation to victims and families of the 1998 attacks on American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Sudan is the third Arab nation to agree to recognize Israel after the UAE and Bahrain signed similar deals with the regime last month. Trump even seeks more normalization agreements with other Arab states, including Saudi Arabia. But questions arise as why those accords reached just ahead of the November presidential election in the U.S., the reason being Trump himself, who is trailing behind his Democratic rival Joe Biden in opinion polls, with his re-election bid affected by plenty of domestic and foreign issues. While Trump's image remains questionable at home, the normalization deals are seen as his last-ditch effort to boost support in order to secure a second term in office.
Joining me in this debate show will be Professor of Political Science with Versailles University, Saad An-Nimr from Ramallah, and political activist Ali Al-Faraji joining us from Birmingham. Good to have you on the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Ramallah first. Professor An-Nimr, some observers argue that Sudan has been pressurized into accepting to work towards signing this deal with Israel, and some others believe that the country has been blackmailed. How do you look at it?
As a matter of fact, as you said, it's not just pressurized. They were blackmailed obviously. They were blackmailed, not only with the $335 million that they had to pay to the victims, as they call between brackets, to the victims in America of Al-Qaeda doing in 1988, but also to take their name off the American records of terrorism. They needed to do anything because they were looking forward for, you know, some agreement with the World Bank to have some loans, and they can't do that as far as they are in the terrorist list by the Americans. So they were blackmailed, but apparently the American conditions were not only the $335 million, which, by the way, paid by Emirates to the Saudis, to the Sudanese, to pay it to the Americans, but also the other condition was to recognize Israel and to normalize the relationship. And the Americans were pressurizing Sudan just 10 days before the elections started in the United States, and less than 2 weeks for Trump to try to achieve something for his own election. So it's a quite clear situation of blackmailing Sudan and try to pressurize Sudan in order to take off their name from the terrorist list and to just get them the aid which they desperately needed after a while, the bad situation economically. So they were under this pressure by the Americans to normalize with Israel.
Now let me turn to Birmingham, to Ali Al-Faraj. Ali, Sudan has no parliament and elections are due in 2 years' time. Does this not question the authority of the administration to make such a decision?
Of course, there is a legislative vacuum in Sudan, as the transitional government in Sudan is run by the military, and they have no right to do such big deals. In fact, there is the pressure from the United States and from the Trump government has been made in a rush because of the American election. It has nothing to do with the Sudanese interest. There is a clear opposition from people of Sudan. We've seen hundreds of thousands of people protesting in Khartoum, only the capital, and the opposition, the political parties in Sudan are against this deal. So there is no ground for such deal at all. In fact, the Sudan itself, as a country, big country, will not benefit much from such deal. So there is no backup or legal part of the deal. In fact, the Sudanese themselves, they don't know what is this deal about. It's just done so that there will be normal relationship between Sudan and Zionist regime, without the Sudanese actually getting much. 300 million is nothing in comparing it to a country like Sudan. I mean, looking into the history, the United States has put Sudan under an embargo for several decades, in which Sudan lost billions of dollars, not $300 million. So, maybe the only people who would benefit in Sudan are some of the military leaders because of the history of being put under the terrorist list and the American terrorist list, and these are the people who would benefit, but probably because they don't want to lose their popularity in Sudan by agreeing directly, and this is the reason why there is some hesitancy in the Sudanese government and their announcements.
Now, Professor Nem, leader of the Popular Congress Party, Kamal Omar, argues that Sudan's transitional government is not elected, so it's not authorized to normalize relations with Israel. We also have former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi slamming this decision and saying that this is in contravention of the Sudanese national law. Your comment, please.
The formation of this government came after the revolution happened in Sudan in the last year, which came to an agreement that it will be between the military on the one hand and the civilians on the other hand, and after 2 years there will be an exchange and the civilian will take over and they will restore democracy and restore civil administration generally in Sudan. But till now there isn't any real thing happening, because this formation already came by an agreement, not by the elections. So far they don't have a parliament in Sudan, and the formation of the government so far, it came by only the parties which participated in the revolution the last year and a half, which they pressurized to finish the previous government and to bring in the military and the civil government together in this formation. But it is not backed by parliament, because they're supposed to have an elections, but the military again they postpone, because they are now having their term of 2 years running the country. So the country now is run by the military generally, not by the civilians, and that's why they postpone the elections for a parliament, which would make things more real. So because of that, there is a huge rejection in Sudan, and the demonstrations today and the burning of the so-called the place where supposed to have the Israeli embassy, the building, it was burned today, and the people of Sudan is expressing their rejection, their real rejection to any move towards the Israeli normalization, because they know by the end of the day, first of all, they are not going to gain anything of this game, and secondly, they are not going to let down the Arab people as well as the Palestinian people and normalize with the enemy of the Arab entity in general, just because of the American pressure and because of the American to please the American rather. So because of that, we think that yes, the decision is not from the legal perspective is not correct, and they have to go back to the people to take such an agreement into reality. So because of the objection of most of the parties and the people, it shouldn't go ahead. And if they sign it, there will be lots of problems in Sudan.
Now, Ali Al-Faraj, in addition to the people that Professor Nair also mentioned, major political parties in Sudan have opposed the deal with Tel Aviv, and they have promised to form an opposition front. What do you expect could happen?
This is obviously expected, because people of Sudan, they are against normalizing relationship with Israel. In fact, the government in Sudan, for several years now, has not been going with what people of Sudan want. And for example, we can only understand the position of the military today if we understand how they are allied to the Saudi regime and to the Emirati regime, to the UAE regime, and the way they contributed to the war in Yemen, and the war in Yemen is pro-American, pro-Israeli war, actually. So this can only be understood by understanding the complexity in the region and how the Sudanese military is part of this coalition in a way. So they can't, unfortunately, they haven't, they're not following what the people of Sudan want or what the political parties in Sudan want. And this is the reason why they're delaying the election, because they know the result of the election. Unfortunately, in Sudan, usually when a military power, when the army takes over the power, they lost. They stay in power. They don't give it to a democratic system. And this has been observed with Omar al-Bashir before and other presidents in Sudan, unfortunately, because they are acting on the American agenda in the region, in the region, which is supporting dictators and supporting people that do not actually represent the people. They don't actually represent the people of Sudan or the people in this region.
Now, Professor Nembra, some analysts believe that President Trump wishes to gain the votes of supporters of the Israeli lobby by brokering this so-called normalization deal. Do you share the same view?
Well, sure, definitely. Remember that the original people who are in support of President Trump in the American elections are the Christian conservatives, and mainly the evangelical Christian, who are totally in support of Israel and in support of Zionism. And he tried to gain them. They are the base for his voters, the white supremacist and the one who are on the top white people in America. So he wanted to gain the support of those. And these are the also wealthy American who are paying him well for his election campaign and paying also around the different states to ensure the electing Donald Trump for a second term. So definitely the Trump is trying to give them all the indications that he's the only supporter to Israel, in spite of the fact that Democrats historically used to be the main supporter to Israel, but now he's saying that me as a person, Trump, I am the only president in America who dared to move the embassy, who dared to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, who recognized Golan Heights as part of Israel, who's announcing agreeing on the annexation of parts of the West Bank, and is in support of Israel totally, and to normalize the relationship with Israel in the region with Arab state. But let me just give you, on the other hand, a small information.
Sure.
A poll was conducted in the Arab world, showed that only 5% in the Arab world, totally, only 5% in support of normalization. Most of the 95% of the Arab people are against normalization. So what we saw in the social media is the electronic flies.
Okay. Now, Ali Al-Faraj, what's behind Washington's push for Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel, even with a crisis in a country like Sudan? I mean, does it serve the upcoming U.S. presidential election, or is there more to it than meets the eye?
It's clear if we have a look at how this is happening in the Middle East, the normalization with the Zionist regime, you see it is done in a way, in steps, in a way, one country after another, so that once there is a party or something happens with one country, then they wait for a few weeks, then there is another country, and then they wait. So in a way, to keep it in the media all the time, to keep it as the news coming all the time, to serve the American election, to serve President Trump, so that this idea of fake achievement, basically, it will be there in the media all the time. And that indicates clearly that President Trump wants this to be on the news every day, every other week or so, so that there will be more people in support of him in his election. Usually in the normal circumstances, people do not make deals like this. Countries who are independent, they negotiate, they talk about it for a while, and then they announce what sort of agreements and disagreements, etc., etc., before they sign an agreement, before they agree something,
right.
And they make a deal, for example. While what we have seen, for example, with Bahrain, just as an example, is they announced the normalization before even the deal has been done,
right.
Before any negotiation has been done, which all indicates that this is all done as an impulsive decision by the American government for the election in the U.S. rather than for the interest of the region.
Okay. Now, I got one last question for both of you gentlemen. What choice or choices are Palestinians left with to defend their cause and free their occupied land now that some Arab countries seemingly are slated to normalize ties with Israel? Professor Nem, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, in a very short, let me just put it, the Palestinians should change their own mentality regarding the struggle generally. Mm-hmm. I believe personally that Israel had came to its final episodes. That's why the Trump and others are trying to normalize relations to just give credibility to Israel and more, recognition to Israel. But in reality, no, it's coming to its final episodes, and I believe mm-hmm. that the Palestinian Authority and all Palestinian factions, first, they have to reunite under one strategy, which is to fight the whole project. There is no illusion about going back to negotiation with Israel. It should be a decision by all Palestinian factions to choose first their own allies, where to stand, beside whom in the region. And we have the front of resistance, as generally from Iran to Syria, okay. Iraq, Hezbollah, and the Palestinians, and on the other hand, to start the struggle against this Israel in any way we could have in our hands.
Okay, Ali Al-Faraj, please go ahead briefly.
Yeah, obviously, in the Palestinian, now the position is clear from all the Palestinian leaders that actually this is not something, an area of dispute, that there is no support for such normalization of any of the Arab or Middle East countries with the Zionist regime. All the political parties in Palestine are against such deals because they are stabbing them in the back, basically. They support without any gain for the Palestinian people. Gaza is still under an embargo. The Palestinian people are still suffering. So there isn't an independent state. Every now and then, Mr. Trump would announce something against the Palestinian people. So there is no benefit. In fact, this is all against the interest of the Palestinian people. It's against the peace in the Middle East.
Because
without the presence of a Palestinian state, how can there be a peace in the Middle East?